Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, dear listeners, and welcome to another episode of Dr. Matt and Dr. Mike's medical podcast. Today, we'll be covering the topic blood. Now, Mike, you might be asking yourself, why isn't Mike doing the introduction like he normally does? Well, Mike's incapacitated today, and so we've got a special guest. We've got a hematologist from Eastern Europe in particular, or specifically, Romania. And this is a...
Well, specifically Transylvania.
So we've got Dr. Drac, his name, or Drake? Drac.
No, it's Dr. Acula.
Acula, Dr. Acula.
Yes.
So you do look a lot like Mike.
Yes. Just taking his body, making you feel a little bit comfortable. Like you said, Mike is a little bit incapacitated at the moment, but I've taken his body and I don't mind it. It's quite taut and muscular and attractive. Yes.
Seems like you've taken his ego as well. So Mike, no, sorry, Dracula.
Dr. Acula.
Dr. Acula.
Yes.
Today we're going to cover the blood, an overview of the blood, introduction to the blood. So we've got a lot to cover. Now, you're an expert. You're a hematologist, so you're a specialist.
One of the first hematologists, actually.
Is that right?
Yes.
So how long have you been studying blood for?
750 years.
Oh, that's exact.
Yeah. It's been... look, I'm the first hematologist. I'm the first person to actually examine blood. Not just examine it for its components, but know exactly what's inside of it, what makes it such a life force, such a delicious topic to study.
Well, with that point, can you explain to the listeners quickly what is blood?
Well, blood, like
before
I said,
you describe what how it tastes.
Well, it is the life force. Yeah. It carries everything. It carries the feelings, the emotions, the thoughts. It carries the temperature of the individual.
Right.
About
38 degrees.
Yeah, it carries the pH of an individual that's around about 7.35, 7.45. Anything above or below this, I don't like. It makes up around about 5 to 6 liters of a male and 4 to 5 liters of a female.
Adult.
That's right. So depending on if you want to have a...
600 mils for a newborn.
Yes. So if you want to have...
I assume you haven't taken the blood from a newborn.
Look, if you want to have a big night out, you find a male.
Right.
That's what I say.
Okay.
It's a connective tissue.
Is it?
Did you know that? Yes.
That sounds a bit odd because you usually think connective tissue like, you know, bones and ligaments.
Yes, don't taste as good, but blood is connective tissue, which means...
So what's the definition of connective tissue then?
Well, it supports.
Okay.
It binds.
So I can't see blood binding.
No, but it supports.
It supports. I'll give you that.
Yeah, so it's made up of cells, gels, and fibers.
So blood is made up of cells, gels, and fibers. That's well, right. Definitely cells, so it's got a cellular component.
Yep.
Gels, fibers I'll give you for sure, because like fibrinogen, which is important for clotting. Gels, well, or ground substance.
That's right.
So that's plasma.
Correct.
So if you were to separate blood into its two components, you could say it's got a cellular component and a plasma component, which is just a fluid component.
We often call the cellular components formed elements.
Okay.
At least us hematologists.
Right. We'll get to the separation in a minute.
Yes, yes.
Is there any other qualities of blood you want to talk about?
Well, we have known about the importance of blood as a life force for not just hundreds but thousands of years. The Greeks and the Romans knew that.
I think pretty much they would have known as early as humans have been able to think that blood's pretty important, right?
Yes, well, once it leaves the body, so does your soul.
Yeah. So well, I'm pretty sure they realized as soon as a certain amount leaked out, the person didn't hang around very long.
Yes, or was siphoned out, potentially. You'll find that...
In your case, that is.
Yes, well...
Through, you know, usually medical doctors do it with a syringe, but you still seem to do it with incisors.
Oh, I can do it with no hands.
Or your canines.
My canines. If you have a look, you'll see that they look similar to syringes. Right at the very end, hollow. And
Oh, they're hollow.
Yes, they work through capillary action.
You should possibly see a dentist. There might be a root canal issue there.
Ah, please. Please. Please, I've seen enough dentists. They taste horrible. I think if we're going to start looking at blood, we should break down its components. What do you think?
Well, let's just mention the main roles of it.
Oh, yeah.
And then we'll get into the components.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so.
One, tasty. Two, delicious. Three, makes me feel good. Makes me feel young again. Are they the functions you were going to go through?
Not really.
Oh, okay.
Not really.
What are your functions?
Well, in terms of what it does for us, a number of things. I've got a list here.
Okay.
But I don't actually think they're that informative, to be honest.
Well, I'll be the judge of that. I'm the hematologist.
So a lot of it's around transport. So it is a fluid. We know it's a fluid. And it's one of its main roles is to transport things around the body throughout or among cells. So we're a multicellular organism. And we
are a multi-organ organism too.
That's true. We need to ensure all the important constituents that a cell needs to survive has that delivered to it.
Has what?
What does it need?
Oxygen.
Oh, oxygen. So you need the components to be able to make energy.
Nutrients.
So we'd say, by and large, oxygen and glucose, if we're going to be very simple. But then... certain metabolic...
It's easy for you, isn't it?
Metabolic waste products like CO2 have to be taken away, otherwise pH will change and then the cell die.
And urea.
And
that needs to be taken away. Horrible tasting. Horrible.
Well, that's from proteins.
Yes.
But then you have...
So you never drink the blood of a bodybuilder. So much urea and it's a little bit acidic.
What about lactic acid?
Oh, yeah. You never take it straight after exercise. Blah.
Blah. So does it taste...
acidic.
What is that, bitter?
Like vinegar.
Oh, like vinegar.
Yeah, gross. Like apple cider vinegar. You know, you have all these people on TV saying the health benefits of apple cider vinegar. Suck the blood of somebody who's just done 100-meter sprints and you'll realize that it's the worst thing you should ever take.
Right. Let's get back to the functions.
Sure.
So transport's definitely one.
Yes.
So let me just do a sidetrack digression. You've done a lot of lab work with in vitro cells, right?
Yeah, I've taken a lot of cell work. I've taken a lot of blood.
Right. So if you've got a petri dish of cells and you had them on that dish, they won't survive very long without the right constituents in that media, that fluid that you put on them, right?
Sure.
So they need oxygen. They need a right temperature. They also need all the nutrients, right? So you... as a scientist that has to keep those cells alive, you have to constantly refresh that fluid, right? So when we evolved from a unicellular organism, which was just a one cell, that can get all the nutrients, all these things from the environment through diffusion. Once we became multicellular and very large, we needed a better system to deliver this, would you say?
So you're saying that because there's so many cells, they can't just suck the nutrients up because one cell may be sitting more deeply within the collection of cells and they're surrounded by other cells. They can't get to that nutrient source.
Yeah.
And so particularly they need a direct delivery route to it.
Yeah. And particularly for animals like those that live on land. I mean, some animals in the sea can still get from the seawater. They can just kind of soak it in. But for us on land, we need a more elaborate circulation system, which is where blood comes in. So you need to deliver this fluid to all 30 trillion cells. Yeah?
Yeah.
Oxygen being very important, glucose very, very important, but also taking the waste products away. But blood doesn't really stay the same, right? So if you go to different parts of the body, the composition of what's in the blood is going to be different.
Yes.
So for instance, in your lungs, the blood in your lungs, you know, the capillaries in your lungs, is going to be super high in oxygen compared to, say, down in the muscles because it's used up all the oxygen.
Yeah.
And CO2, vice versa.
Yep.
You take it to your GIT, it's going to be filled with nutrients that you've just eaten to be pushed into the blood, and then it's going to be taken to the body. You go to the kidney and it might be it's just spat out of the nephron. The composition of the blood there is going to have, you know, different levels of water because it's just kind of petered out and waste products. So it's, I guess what I'm saying is depending on where you are in the body, things are going to be slightly different.
That's right. And that's why it's really important for me to take blood from the carotid. I always take blood from the carotid.
One of the...
jugular.
Yeah. I thought that'd be better.
Venous blood, really. No, we need the high flow.
So why is venous blood a different color?
Because of the
Is that true?
Yes, it is. It is. So it's about different hues of red. And so when you've got that oxygenated blood, it's that lighter, brighter, more colorful red. It allows for your eyes and your fangs to be attracted to it. And so the great thing about the carotid is it's easy to find when that neck's held back to the side, you can see it pulsating.
Right.
Basically saying, come here, have a drink.
You sound like a mosquito. Now, there's a reason for why the colour's changed. The hemoglobin, which is a component in the red blood cell, has got iron in it. And we know that when iron is exposed to oxygen, like in the environment, it rusts, so it goes a different colour of red.
Don't say that blood's rusting because you should know. Stop trying to put me off blood.
Yeah. Doesn't it have a metallic taste?
It does have a metallic taste, actually.
Well, that's the iron.
Okay.
So that's the iron.
Yeah.
So
I am often low in iron every time I go get, strangely enough, a blood test. So sometimes I have to give blood, not just take it. And low in iron, which is probably one of the reasons why I love blood, right?
Well, I actually was going to say this to you. I think you actually you have anemia.
What do you mean?
Well, you're very pale.
Okay. It's hard to get sun when you disintegrate in it.
That's well, I'll get to that point. So pallor is a sign of anemia.
All right.
Okay. Photophobia.
Yeah.
Arguably also.
Don't like the light.
Fair. Your gums have retracted somewhat, hence why your canines stick out.
All right, I don't floss. Nice going with pointing that out.
And you lack energy.
Look.
Or vigor.
Well, you've got me
and
up.
And you're craving like...
How dare you say I lack vigor.
And you crave like meat products or in this case blood. So yeah. I think you just got anemia.
What about my teeth?
I told you about that. That's just a retraction of your gums.
Oh. I'm 750 years old.
It's true. Anyway, we'll get to anemias in a second. Back to the function. So transport's very important.
I'll make you anemic.
So that's gases, nutrients, getting rid of the waste products, which we also kind of spoke about. The immune function. So a big part of the cells in your blood are white blood cells, which keep you from being infected by the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Coagulation. So that's to stop in bleeding. And again, we'll get to that process, which we call hemostasis. And then transporting again, like this time it's hormone. So if you take blood through an endocrine gland, then the composition of hormones is going to be higher in that location as well than it would be elsewhere. So if you, the blood that's leaving the pancreas arguably will be higher in insulin.
Yeah.
So this is an example of where things change in the blood depending on where you are.
And that's why for me, you know, if I'm thirsty, you know how sometimes after a meal you crave something sweet? So I sometimes go look out for a diabetic because...
How do you know that?
Well, you can smell it. Yeah. you can smell a diabetic a mile away as a vampire. Okay. As a vampire.
Yeah, I'm glad you clarified that.
And you can just taste that glucose in the blood.
Well, it's actually glucose in there on the hemoglobin.
What do you mean?
Well, how long does a red blood cell last for?
About 120 days.
Yeah. So about 3 months.
Yeah.
Right. So if you take not the way you do it.
Okay.
But if you take a blood test, you can look at a, it's called glycosylation, I think it's
the term,
of the hemoglobin. So it's almost like the sugar crystals, it's not really, but just go with the analogy, sugar crystals on the hemoglobin, which is called a HbA1c test. And the scientists can calculate the percentage of how much your hemoglobin has sugar crystals on it. And that's a good indication of how high the blood sugar has been over a 3 month period, because that's how long the red blood cells last for.
Ah, so that's what I'm tasting. I'm just tasting.
And because a red blood cell is like,
it's like a glazed donut. It's like a glazed donut.
That's right. So you're really just craving whatever
Krispy
donut.
Krispy Kreme.
Yeah, that's right.
So every time I have a diabetic's blood, I might as well just go get a Krispy Kreme.
Correct. So if you're above 7% of that test, that's an indication that you haven't maintained your blood sugar levels for a 3 month period.
Gotcha.
So that's why a diabetic can't really cheat a sugar blood test, technically. Like you could,
do they try?
If you did a random one,
yeah,
they might. So if you went to the doctor and they just randomly took a blood test and it was below, let's say, 6 millimoles a liter, the doctor might be happy and say, "Well done, your blood sugar's good," but they might have just complied with it at that period.
Yeah.
But if they do this test,
oh, gotcha,
they got
gotcha.
3 months of data to say, actually, no.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting.
So this is probably the reason why you like the diabetic's blood, because it's just like
mini cinnamon donuts. I like that. Okay, so for functions, we've got transport, and transport's going to be...
And a lot of stuff.
Oxygen, nutrients, hormones, and you've got...
Waste products,
and you've also got immune function with the white blood cells. Anything else?
There's an interesting one which I didn't really... Well, here's another side one, which I don't think you'll agree with, but blood pressure.
Yeah.
But I thought about it, and it does partially make sense. In the plasma part of your... Well, you know that thickness of blood...
Firstly, let me just say, blood pressure is a simple equation, which is how much blood is pumped out of the heart per minute, called the cardiac output, times how much resistance is present in the bloodstream. Now, I assume you're going to start talking about the resistance in the bloodstream as being a contributing factor to blood
pressure.
Well,
I'll get to this. Well, initially I would agree, but I think I've sold where you could argue for blood pressure having a role from blood itself.
Well, I'll be the judge.
Okay, firstly, and this is the weakest argument side of things, the thickness of blood will have some small effect on blood pressure.
The viscosity.
Yeah.
All right.
Would you agree?
Yes, it does.
Very small amount?
A very small amount, right, but it does contribute to... systemic vascular resistance, yep.
Okay. And then within the plasma, which is about 55% of the whole blood, you've got dissolved in that a protein called albumin.
Okay.
Which will pull fluid back into the blood.
Sure.
So if you don't have albumin, you're going to have edema. So you're going to have more of your fluid in tissue.
Sure.
So less volume.
Okay.
Less blood volume. Therefore, less preload. Or return in blood, therefore less cardiac output.
All right, now let me counter argue by saying that while albumin is transported in the blood, it is a product of the liver. And so
you would argue that albumin is in the blood.
You would argue it's in the blood, but you wouldn't say that blood itself is what's determining the quantity of albumin present.
Correct.
So albumin could be lost due to liver damage. It could be lost due to inflammation because more's been pushed out. It could be lost due to right side heart failure because you've got increased venous pressure, which is going to be pushing more proteins out at the capillaries as well. And none of that has to do with the blood. Yeah, that happens.
I don't think heart failure will affect the albumin, though. It's just affecting the hydrostatic forces.
It does affect the hydrostatic forces, but you'll find that the hydrostatic forces can increase the outward push, right?
So it pushes the albumin out?
It can, yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes, it can.
I know that.
Yep.
Thank you, Dracula, for that.
No, who is Dr. Acula?
Dr. Acula. Okay, and then the final one, which is a really interesting function, but yes. I don't think it's that, well...
Just say
is, hydraulics.
What do you mean?
It's used as a hydraulic fluid.
What do you mean? In what way?
Okay. We could go to a peripheral nervous system function, parasympathetic nervous system function.
Okay.
In a male.
Oh. See. Okay. So you're saying like a lever system.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So. Yeah. That's so specific.
It's true though.
Yeah, it's true, but all it is an accumulation of blood and then an occlusion of drainage.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, I thought it was interesting.
It is interesting.
Maybe another.
But again, is it a function of blood?
Well, if you didn't have blood, that wouldn't occur.
True. But if you didn't have blood, nothing's going to occur.
And that's actually the way that they reverse that process. They draw blood out of it.
Yes. Thankfully, they've never called on me to do that. And they've always used a syringe.
Very good.
So, I think you've done a good job of outlining the functions there. I think.
I wonder if the during the listeners got what we were referring to. I think.
I think we can breeze past that one. So I think when we look at blood, and this is what I'm going to do. This is what I've done in my early studies because I'm so interested in blood and the components of blood because I want to know what's the best blood, the best blood. So, I've collected. So much blood from so many people. And the best way to do it is you suck it out, or you'd probably say you get a syringe and take it out and then put it into a tube and you spin this tube down. Right? Now, when you spin the tube down, you get three distinct layers of blood. You get the lightest layer, which goes to the top. You get the middle layer and then the heaviest layer down the bottom.
All right.
Now,
and that's just by density.
Yeah, by weight, like I just said. So the lightest layer at the top is going to be things like water, right? This is the plasma.
Okay.
Okay.
And this is the majority.
Yeah. This is transparent. 55% of the whole blood is plasma. Then.
Can I stop you there? I give plasma as a donation.
And no one wants it.
And it's literally the same color as urine. Actually, quite a darker urine.
And.
Like probably a dehydrated urine color.
Do you want to know why?
Sure.
Well. All your blood is moving through your kidneys to be filtered.
Yep.
Okay. So every minute, your heart pumps out 5 liters of blood. Of this 5 liters, around about 1 liter goes to the kidneys. Of this 1 liter, only some of it is filterable because things are too big. And it's the bottom two layers that are too big to be filtered, so only the top layer.
So the buffy coat and the urethrocytes.
So, yeah. So in effect, you're filtering out around about 120 mils per minute. Of this 1 liter that's coming through, okay? And you end up filtering about 170 liters a day, right?
It's a lot.
Even more, 200 liters per day. Sometimes 250 liters per day, which is a lot, but you reclaim most of that. But what you're left with is the stuff that's in the plasma that was in high abundance that you didn't need. So what is in that plasma, that 55% of whole blood? Three main things. Water, which makes up 92%,
okay.
Proteins, which make up 7%, and solutes, so dissolved stuff, makes up less than 1%.
Okay.
So the water's easy. We know what water is. It makes up the most of our plasma.
So just to reiterate, 55% of your blood.
All of it.
So if you take a tube of blood out, like if you get a blood test, put it in a, what size tube is that? Like
doesn't 15, matter.
15 mil tube. They spin it down. 55%, which sits on the top, is plasma. And of that plasma, 92% is water.
Yep.
7% is proteins. And less than 1% is just dissolved solutes.
Yes. Do you want me to say it again? We'll do it for a fourth time.
That's wonderful. All right. So we'll leave water because everyone knows what it is. What water is.
Tastes horrible.
Protein.
Yes.
Talk about that. So what's the proteins in your plasma? And I guess you'd call it plasma proteins, right?
That's good. Yes, it is. Very smart. There's many different types. Three that we should probably talk about. Or at least one we should probably talk about, which is albumin.
At least 100 types.
Do you want to talk about them all?
Not today.
Okay. Albumin is probably the most important. Yep. You'd agree. Produced in the liver, carried in the blood, has a number of important roles. Probably two most important roles of albumin is that it's a transport molecule for fat-soluble substances.
Yep.
So if something's water-soluble, it means it loves water. It's just going to float all the way through water. All good. If something is fat-soluble, hates water. So it needs something to help carry it, and that's albumin. So this may be hormones, maybe drugs, whatever.
Yep. Okay, so it's good. Yep.
It also plays a role, like you were talking about earlier, in osmotic pressure. So when you've got a capillary, you've got holes in capillaries, and you're going to have the blood pressure, which is going to be pushing stuff out. Anything that's small enough to get through is going to go out. But luckily, there's proteins inside that capillary that are too big to leave, and they have a negative charge associated with them, proteins, because there's a lot of phosphates.
So that's why, because some students might think, well, the red blood cells and white blood cells are bigger than the albumin.
Yeah.
So why don't they do the pulling force?
Yes.
It's just because of the negative charge.
Correct. Okay. Yep. And so, and because albumin is one of the most abundant proteins, yeah, it's going to be one of the most important for pulling water back in. So it reclaims that fluid.
Okay.
And so that's extremely important.
So if you didn't have enough albumin,
yeah,
and so two examples of why you might have this, liver disease,
yep,
or maybe kidney disease where you're peeing out a lot of albumin.
Yeah, yeah, like glomerulonephritis or something.
So you're losing your albumin, therefore you're not going to have that pulling pressure back into the capillaries.
Yeah.
Therefore the fluid will stay off in the capillary or in the tissue of the capillaries. So examples would be you could have swollen tissues. I don't know if it's specifically legs in this case. I think it can be strange locations like under the eyes. Obviously, liver issues is in the abdomen, which they call ascites.
Yeah.
And I think there's a certain formula, which I don't know, that you could have a person that has ascites, which is fluid in their abdomen, up to, I don't know, I'm guessing, potentially up to 10 liters of fluid in their peritoneal space. But each liter that you pull out, I think you've got to put a certain amount of albumin back in.
Wow.
But I don't know the formula.
Wow.
But I'm just aware of it. So liver or kidney issues could affect that albumin, therefore affect that osmotic pressure.
Yeah, really important, really important. So that's one of the most important proteins. Globulins are another important type, which play an important immune role, most specifically.
Antibodies. That's a good one.
That's right. And can play a clotting role. And talking about clotting, another important protein is fibrinogen, which is, again, produced by the liver.
So it's inactive.
Yes.
In that form.
Yeah. If you have an exam and it asks you about where a particular protein is made and it ends in O-G-E-N, most of these proteins are made in the liver.
Yeah,
so
right.
Fibrinogen, angiotensinogen, they're all made in the liver.
Right, pepsinogen.
Pepsinogen is made at the stomach chief cells. Okay. So, all right, cool. Thanks for that.
Okay.
So most. I said most.
Yep.
And then, so yeah, fibrinogen we'll talk about shortly, important with clotting. So when we start talking about platelets, fibrinogen's important. All right, they're the proteins. The other important aspect of plasma is solutes. So less than 1% of that 55% of plasma is solutes. So what are solutes?
Molecules dissolved in a solvent.
Yeah, and the universal solvent in biology is water.
Yeah.
So anything dissolved in water, and that's going to be ions, nutrients, gases, waste. What type of ions are going to be in blood?
Well, there's many of them, but I think the main ones to be mindful of is sodium, which is a cation, potassium, also cation, chloride.
You know what we missed out on talking about?
Yeah.
Really important. Is blood extracellular fluid or intracellular fluid?
Extra.
So
if you look at extracellular fluid, it's broken up into two main parts that I'm aware of. Interstitial, between the cells, and intravascular, which is what this is.
Yeah, and this is super important because it means whatever's in the blood is going to be between the cells.
Yeah.
And whatever you ingest will be in the blood, right? So if you drink it or eat it, it's going to get in the blood.
If the liver allows it to. I mean, if you can absorb it and the liver allows it to get in the blood.
Correct. Yes. And if it gets in the blood, it's going to move out of the blood. And if it's out of the blood, it's going to be between the tissues. And there's a concentration of stuff between the tissues. And that can change concentration gradients. So what I'm saying is, if you find out what the most abundant extracellular stuff is, that's going to be what's in the blood and vice versa. So if you drink a lot of salt, a lot of that, or eat a lot of salt, that salt's ultimately going to end up outside the cells.
Yep.
And your kidneys are going to have a, you know.
Or just go with that for the time being. So you have a lot of salt in your diet, let's say, or you just have a huge salty meal. That salt, we'll just go with sodium at this point, will go into your blood, and then it goes into the extracellular space or the interstitial space, which means now there's an osmotic gradient to pull fluid from the cell into the space.
That's right.
So you start to get edema.
Yeah.
To a point in time, and I'm sure you'd be able to somehow eventually filter it out. But that's probably why you get thirsty.
Yes.
After a salty meal.
Yeah, and that's why I never, ever drink the blood of somebody who's just had a packet of chips or popcorn or anything like that, because my meal is also my liquid,
right?
So I satiate the same way that I hydrate. So if I have a salty meal, I got to go drink more blood. I'll be over full on blood. Yeah. It's ridiculous. So I got to find someone who's nice, well hydrated, and then end up stumbling across somebody who's been kicking keto hard. And so I end up getting all this fat in my blood. It makes me feel gross.
Oh, yeah.
Stop it, keto guys.
Do they block your fangs up, the fat?
Oh, it's just gross. It just tastes yuck. You know, they've got all, they put like oil and MCT in their coffee.
What's it? MCT?
MCT oil.
Oh, don't know what that is.
Who does? They don't. And then what ends up happening after they get diarrhea is I end up drinking their blood. And then I've just got fat in my fangs.
There you go.
Now, all right. So that's the ions. Now the nutrients. This is what I'm after. I'm after the nutrients. And the types of nutrients you're going to find is anything that you eat. So your macronutrients get broken. You know, fats, proteins, carbs get broken down into micronutrients, which is spoken about. Well, you and Michael have spoken about many times before, but because I'm embodying him, I have his memories. He's got horrible memories of you, by the way. Anyway, these nutrients. Include glucose, can include amino acids. Fats are a little bit different because fats get absorbed into the lymphatic system and then jump into the venous and then get transported to particular tissues.
So fat can also travel with the proteins too, right?
That's right.
To make the high density or the low density lipoproteins.
Correct. Mm. Yeah, correct. And gases, oxygen, carbon dioxide. Nitrogen sort of just floating through. Don't really care about that one. And waste, like urea. So
creatinine.
Creatinine, yes.
What about lactate? Is that a waste?
No, lactate's a normal byproduct of glycolysis.
Yep.
See, I've just pulled that from Michael's memory. He's very good at metabolism, by the way.
Right.
Just letting you know, all this stuff that's coming through. God is attractive and smart. So that is the plasma. That's the 55% of all your blood. Water, protein, solutes.
Brilliant. Now, in that order.
In that, well.
Of concentration.
Yes. What's the next, the smallest amount, the next layer, which looks like this sort of.
Buffy. Wasn't Buffy a vampire slayer?
Yes. So every time I say it, I cringe a little bit. But yes, Buffy was a vampire.
You need to bring Buffy back. That's all I reckon.
Yeah, look, Buffy was a great show to watch. People try and emulate Buffy and they're never successful, obviously. There's been a lot of vampires over the years. Do you know who the worst vampire was? The Twilight vampires.
Okay.
They're vegetarian.
Is that possible?
My world.
Maybe they've got an ethical conscience.
I mean, you're not even a vampire then. What are you? You just are
anemic. Have you ever taken blood from an animal?
Oh, look, when you're desperate, you got to do what you got to do.
Did you know other animals have different coloured blood?
Really?
Yeah.
Like what?
Well, when we get into...
I really stopped to look.
Well, invertebrates, should I say, vertebrates will generally have red blood because of hemoglobin.
Oh, not invertebrates.
That's right. That's why I got to stop.
Because I've never sucked the blood of an invertebrate, by the way. It's too difficult.
That would be hard.
Yeah.
So a vertebrate will have red blood by and large because of... the hemoglobin.
Yeah.
So once we get to a point, and I guess we'll do this when we talk about red blood cells, but once we get to the point where we need a lot of energy, so our metabolism's high, we need to make a lot of energy, we start to put a pigment into the blood. Because remember, at this point, it's just a fluid, a transporting fluid. So once you start to put a pigment into it, that will change the color of it. And so that gives it a bit better ability to carry more oxygen.
So is that the heme or is that the globin?
I'd say the heme, so the iron component. So the globulin is the protein, which we spoke about, but the heme is what I forget the chemical structure, but then it has four chunks of iron off.
That's right.
The heme component, right? Yeah. So that gives the red color. But then you could go into other animals, and instead of heme, let me just find the word, hemocyanin, which is instead of the iron, it's copper.
Yeah.
And so this is where you'll get a bluing color. So this is in these animals like octopus, particularly I think octopuses. Is that the correct term?
Yes.
I think we always say this.
No, it is. It's octopuses. It's not octopi. I've been on this world 750 years. Don't say octopi. Okay.
I think in their case, I just forget which way around it goes. I think the octopuses that live in warmer water need a bluer blood.
Okay.
Because they need to carry more oxygen. Where
why do you need more oxygen in warmer water?
Well, there's less oxygen in warmer water than there is in colder water.
Because it's shaking up more and jiggling
I think it's just
carrying
capacity in the water.
The warmer the water, the more it shakes. The more the atoms shake. The more the atoms shake, the more likely gases are going to dissipate.
Okay, fair enough. I just thought you meant it's more turbulent water.
No.
Just at the molecular level.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
So I've never sucked the blood of an octopus, so it's blue.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And there's probably other animals, invertebrates that will have
blood. Well, there's heaps of animals that sort of give their blood to their young.
Yeah, so I think the thing you showed me earlier this morning.
Yeah, so this was an article I read 150 years ago when Nature first sort of came out.
So you read that when it came out?
Yes. I've got all the original editions of Nature. Right. Yes. Yeah, from when it first started in, I think, 1869.
Right.
Yes.
So what did this talk about? That some birds feed blood to their
young. Flamingos.
Right.
Pelicans. Who can fit more in their beak than their belly can?
And a pelican.
It's just a joke.
Okay. So that's blue. And that's
hippopotamus. They've got red.
That's sweat.
But it's not blood, is it? Believe me, I've licked the back of a hippopotamus in desperation. It was just a salty mess. It was not blood, unfortunately.
So what gives it the red color?
I don't know. I didn't ask him.
Okay. Didn't hang around.
I just walked
They've got
off.
A very good healing capacity in their skin, though. I think something to do with the secretions make a very good environment for the healing, because they have a lot of fights. And they live in pretty ordinary
conditions,
water.
Yeah.
And so you'd think they'd get infected, but they've got a very strong healing potential.
Like me. Cut me. Do it.
You just lick it.
Yeah, that's true. Cut you?
And then one other one, and then we'll move on.
Please.
There's some fish in the, ice fish.
Ice fish.
Ice fish.
Yeah, that's its name.
They have clear blood. Because they have no pigment. And then a final point is there's a frog.
On top of the last
there's
one.
There's a frog in New Guinea that has green blood. But the reason how this works is when you break up your red blood cells, which we know has the heme. So all vertebrates, which include frogs, have red blood. Okay. So you'd be saying, well, why is it?
Except this frog that's got green blood.
Yeah. And so you'd be like, that's a question I was going to ask myself.
Okay.
Why isn't it red? Well, the red, as we established, is the heme, which is in the red blood cell. All right. Now, when a red blood cell dies, how long does it last again?
Again, 120 days. Yep. You're short-term memory.
It has to recycle certain components of it because it's otherwise it'd be a huge waste.
Yes.
So
the globin, the heme, and the iron.
Yeah, so the heme component gets taken, which becomes something called biliverdin, gets taken to the liver to get repackaged, right? And so its initial alteration from biliverdin to then bilirubin. I think the biliverdin is green.
Yeah.
So this frog, for some reason, doesn't convert it very well. And so the biliverdin builds up and then makes the blood go green.
Oh.
So similar to, you know, if you've had a very bad bruise.
Yes.
In your skin.
Well, no, but yeah, I've seen them.
In your skin, the first part of the bruise, well, I guess the first part is red, but then it goes green.
Yes.
And then yellow.
Yes.
Okay. So the green is that biliverdin. So this frog likes to live in a environment, well, it's in its blood environment, is ultra high in biliverdin, and it's thought that that protects it against malaria.
Because mosquitoes are just like, this tastes horrific. I would not suck the blood of this.
Of this frog.
Frog, no.
So when you go to New Guinea next, just try it.
Look, there's so many restrictions. I'm stuck in Queensland at the moment. Sucking the blood of Queenslanders.
You're adhering to travel restrictions.
It's, look, I could.
Can you get COVID through drinking blood?
The problem is, it's just not smart to turn into a bat nowadays.
Yeah.
So it's best staying in human form.
Yeah, good point.
All right, the buffy coat, right?
You know, you're a lot funnier than Michael. I think you should hang around longer.
Oh, we'll see.
Okay, Buffy. This was the middle part between the plasma and the erythrocytes.
Erythrocytes, yeah. And it's
only less 1% of the whole blood.
That's right. It looks white in color, and it's,
as you do. Yep.
Thank you. Gotta stop bringing that up. It's made up of white blood cells, right?
And what's the term they use for that?
We call them leukocytes because leuko means white.
And cytes?
Means cell.
That's so spelt with a C-Y-T as opposed to an S.
Yes. Yeah. That's right.
So leukocytes. And so this part here is all about immune, really.
Yeah, about protecting the body. And the great thing is every time I suck somebody's blood, I get their leukocytes. And so I get their antibodies and I get memory and protection against so many different things. People think that as a vampire.
I'd be questionable whether you actually, I think your gastrointestinal system would just break up those cells. I don't think you're going to get them into your own blood.
Okay. Yeah. Who's the hematologist here, mate? So when we look at the leukocytes, the white blood cells, there's a couple of different types. In total, if we take all the white blood cells, there's 10,000 of them per mil of blood. It's a fair bit, right? Now, never let monkeys eat bananas is how I have always been taught.
Never let monkeys eat bananas.
Yeah, so each, this is a mnemonic.
Yep.
The first letter of each tells you the first letter of each white blood cell.
Okay.
In so never, concentration, N? Descending concentration.
Oh, okay, so the N is the most abundant
correct
white blood cell.
That's the neutrophils. They digest bacteria.
Do you know
bacteria.
The percentages?
I don't. No, I don't. So
I think it's in the 60s.
Of total?
Yeah.
Yeah, neutrophils are the most abundant. So neutrophils digest bacteria.
They're also the first white blood cell on the scene to any kind of acute inflammation.
Yeah, you could say that they phagocytose, the phagocytes.
So if you have any kind of early stage infection, generally speaking, your white blood cells is up.
Yeah.
And your neutrophils will be up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lymphocytes, second most abundant. These are our B and T cells. Which have done an episode on the immune system.
Yeah.
So well, at least you and Mike did.
So, yeah. So, we can probably brush over this.
Yes, but
T and B cells?
Yeah, T and B cells are...
So, this is adaptive immune system?
That's right. Yeah, it's probably all we need to say, really. Monocytes. Monocytes are young white blood cells, and they tend to follow the neutrophils when there's some sort of infection or inflammation. And when they jump out of the bloodstream into the tissue, they also turn into phagocytes, specifically macrophages, to further engulf and destroy anything that's there that shouldn't be there.
Okay.
Dead cells, bacteria, whatever it may be. Then the last two, which people don't often talk about, are the eosinophils and basophils. And I'd say a nice way to sort of remember is that eosinophils love to get activated when you're infected by some sort of pathogen like a worm.
Parasites.
And then basophils are activated due to allergies.
Yeah. I think eosinophils are also very important allergies, particularly respiratory. So asthma, allergic asthma, they very high amounts of eosinophils in the bronchioles.
Yes. Both are stimulated due to allergies. But you'd say the eosinophils are probably most strongly activated when you have some sort of parasitic worm, for example.
Yep.
All right. So they are our leukocytes. Then the last type of... I wouldn't say cell, but I'd probably say a cellular component.
Starts with a cell, but definitely...
turns into like this busted little remnant of a cell.
Well, the best way I like to say it is it starts off... Well, the first thing... and this could also substantiate your claim that it's a connected tissue.
Okay.
These cells all originate in bone.
Yes.
And bone is connected tissue.
True.
Okay, so there's a stem cell that produces your blood cells, Okay, it's a hemopoietic stem cell.
Yes, writes many poems.
And so when it copies itself, you can go down. And we'll briefly mention this in hemopoiesis.
Yeah,
but it will go down lineages to decide what it wants to become. So that's why it's a stem cell. It still hasn't completely differentiated. So it can go down, you know, make red blood cells, it can go make the different types of white blood cells, but in this case it's going to make a platelet.
Yeah.
Now when it pops out of the blood, it kind of is what we call a mega carrier site.
So it's mega.
Yeah, so it's very large. Now I think of it like a huge dinner plate.
Right.
And now if you're at a Greek wedding.
Yes.
And
Good blood in the Greeks.
What happens? I don't think you'd like garlic.
I don't like raw garlic.
Okay. Anyway, so back to this mega carrier site. If you get this big dinner
plate.
Unless
it's like garlic bread. That's big, pretty good.
Big dinner plate. Yeah. And just throw it on the ground like at the wedding. What happens to the plate?
It's smashed on the floor.
And so and now you go,
whoppa!
Now you don't have a plate, but you have what?
Little plates.
Platelets.
Okay.
And that's what platelets are.
Thanks, everybody, for joining us at Dr. Matt and Dr. Matt.
So just have small fragments of that one original cell.
It's probably the best joke you've ever made.
Thanks a lot. So that's buffy coat. Yes. Is that enough?
I think we should talk about what platelets do. Let's talk about
Do you want to do the hemostasis now?
Yeah, let's talk about what platelets do. And so I think when we talk about platelets, we talk about clotting. And there's a process called hemostasis. So, for example...
What's heme mean, by the way?
It means blood.
Yeah.
So right?
Hemato or hemo. I think sometimes...
Because I'm a hematologist, so I study blood.
There's sometimes an A before the E.
Yeah, if you're...
Or if you're American.
If you're Australian, like you and Mike.
Just...
Or if you're American, make what it easy.
Romanians?
And it's a...
Is Romanian... Phonetic. Is it British? Do you use British English in Romania?
No, we use Romanian. God, you're a moron.
From the medical side.
Of course, Western centric here.
Okay.
So when we look at hemostasis, so stasis means to stop.
Or imbalance.
Okay. So it means to stop. And
well, you're not stopping blood. You don't want blood to stop.
No, but what you're doing is you're stopping the bleeding process. And so when we look at hemostasis, let's just say, as an example, I bite into your neck to get some blood. So I break the tissue and I have to break the blood vessel in order to drain that blood out for a nice, delicious meal. Unsure whether you'd be delicious or not. That's besides the point. I've punctured the blood vessel. There's damage. Now, you're going to continually bleed out unless something blocks it up. And this is where the platelets come along. Now, the hemostasis has three important phases associated with it.
Wonderful. Right?
Now, the very first phase is this reflexive response that the blood vessel does when it gets damaged, where it goes into spasm and contracts. And now this contraction is important. It's a contraction and constriction in which it tries to limit the loss of blood by contracting the endothelial cells.
That would make sense.
And
the diameter of the blood vessel.
And the diameter of the blood vessel, limiting the amount of blood loss.
Makes sense.
Easy peasy. But
I think that can come about from... like just muscle, like smooth muscle injury, neurological reaction to it, but also from the next step.
Yep. And even things like atherosclerotic plaques can do this type of thing to the blood vessel, particularly this next step.
Okay.
Now, this next step, what's it called?
Platelet plug formation or platelet aggregation. I think this is all just part of the... we'll just say platelet.
The platelet step. Okay.
The platelet step, yeah.
All right. So because the blood vessel is damaged, blood vessel is made up of connective tissue.
Yeah.
And connective tissue often has collagen.
Yep.
And collagen is sticky. And so we've got all this sticky collagen exposed to the lumen or the hollow inside of the blood vessel. And because you've got platelets, you've got something like 300,000 platelets per mil. It's flowing through this blood vessel. It sticks to this sticky collagen.
Yep.
And then once it sticks to the sticky collagen, the platelet gets activated.
Mm.
And when it activates, it releases something called prothrombin activator. And what prothrombin activator does is it takes a protein that's produced again by the liver called prothrombin, which is made by the liver and also requires vitamin K for its production. Prothrombin gets activated by this prothrombin activator and turns into thrombin.
Yep.
And thrombin is like some molecular scissors that take that fibrinogen we spoke about, chops that OGEN off the end and turns it into fibrin, which is like a fine, what would you say? How would you, like a thread, like a fine thread.
And that's the fibrinogen is the part of the connective tissue with the fibers.
Yes, and that fibrin, this fine thread, now starts to bind all these platelets up and binds that area up, and that's why the clotting cascade is now beginning.
Yep.
And so, what you now
and with the clotting cascade, there's a whole abundance of proteins that are inactive.
But
you kind of go step by step by step. That just keeps activating each other, which kind of keeps turning on the next step.
Yeah, you've got direct and indirect aspects of coagulation, this coagulation cascade. But all you need to know is that it forms a clot.
It's almost like, this is the way I kind of thought about it earlier. You know when you go to a hardware store and you buy like super glue, but it's in separate tubes?
Oh, yeah.
So if you take one and try to make it sticky, it won't be effective on its own.
Yeah.
But if you mix the two, then it has a reaction and then causes it to become then gluey-like.
Yeah.
And then
it
will harden and do what you want it to do, right?
Yeah, I think that's a good analogy.
So in this case, you need all these kind of clotting mixtures together to be activated to ultimately activate the clot.
That's right.
So we kind of do this in our surgeries, animal surgeries. We use fibrin glue. And fibrin glue is in an inactive state, but as soon as you put it into the wound, it would come into contact with all these clotting proteins.
Yeah.
And then it will activate it to then become harder.
Yep.
And so it's almost like, the only way you can really describe it is...
I think we did.
No, I just mean the consistency of a clot.
Yeah.
If you've ever... It's a bit gross, but if you've ever cleaned a fish... sometimes when you...
You mean just giving it a bath?
No, like you caught a fish, you want to eat it, so you take the scales off, take off the head, and then
I've never eaten a fish.
Then you take out the visceral organs.
Okay.
And then sometimes at the back abdominal wall is you'll get these clots kind of there.
Okay.
And that's just from their bleeding that then has done all these steps, and you get this kind of... Well, how would you describe it?
Well, that's a gross way to talk about it.
I couldn't really think about... Because you don't really see a clot to do with your own bleeding, really.
It's just like a thicker red jelly.
Yeah. The only other,
which is a family friendly way of talking about it.
The only other additional. Acula. So I think you did a great job of the hemostasis. The only points that I'll just add to it in the platelet plug step, there's a couple of additional points to it. Is the platelets will come along, and like you said, the exposure of the collagen will kind of start to activate them. There's a factor that's kind of mediated here called von Willebrand's factor, I'm sure you met the guy.
I met a lot of the Vons.
And then we get the activation from the platelets releasing through the cyclooxygenase called a COX-1 enzyme. And that would not go down the path to produce prostaglandin, but in this case, thromboxane. Thromboxane is an important kind of mediator, which causes the platelets to aggregate, kind of to come together and hold hands.
Oh, that's
cute. Would you say that's an accurate?
Yeah, point? I'd say that's a nice.
So thromboxane is very important here, because we'll get to it in a second in terms of drug medications. So thromboxane is also quite important, and ADH, which is just a byproduct of ATP production, right? ADP, sorry, ADP. Okay.
I was going to say antidiuretic hormone.
Yeah, definitely not that. ADP, sorry.
Yeah.
And so what's happening here, we go from the injury, the collagen, to the platelets coming around, to them releasing some certain chemicals, which now get them to hold hands. And then the further step is what you said, then it starts to release another hormone, which will then bring in the clotting cascade or the coagulation steps.
Yeah.
Which is... really turning prothrombin into thrombin and then fibrinogen into fibrin, and now you've got a stabilized clot. This is where you can bring your drugs in, your anti-clotting drugs. So aspirin, which is a very common drug, is all around the platelets. So what that drug does is essentially blocks that COX-1 enzyme and stops the thromboxane. So it stops the not the aggravation, the aggregation.
Yeah.
So stops the platelets loitering around the area and starting a clot to begin.
Yep.
So you would give aspirin clinically to prevent the clot even starting.
Yeah.
Okay. That's fair enough, do you think?
Yeah, I hate it when people have aspirin in their blood.
Blah. Very thin.
Blah.
Then another fairly common one is heparin. Now, heparin's interesting because heparin is actually released from your endothelial cells to stop any kind of clotting to even begin. So in your normal blood vessels, right on the endothelial lining, you would always have heparin just there, and it stops blood clotting when it shouldn't. Okay, and I think they first isolated this from maybe pig arteries or blood vessels, and then they figured out how to create it themselves. But heparin kind of prevents the thrombin to cross-link into fibrinogen to fibrin. So it stops the stabilizing effect of the clot. So that could be used a bit further downstream of the clot first starting.
And do you know what the importance of vitamin K is in all this?
And then I'll get to this. That was the next.
Oh, okay.
And then we bring in warfarin.
Yes.
Which has other names. I just can't remember the name of it. Warfarin is...
rat sack. Yeah. That's another name, isn't it?
Well, that wasn't what I was thinking. Oh. But yes, that's another aspect. The vitamin K plays a very important role in the
Can I say?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So what vitamin K does, which obviously it's a vitamin, so we can't make it ourselves. We need to get it from our diet. What vitamin K does is it takes coagulation factors and it does something called carboxylation. And so what that simply means is it takes a coagulation factor and it adds a carbon and two oxygens to it. Now, the thing with carboxylation is that it makes the coagulation factor negatively charged. And this is important because you need all these negative charges on your coagulation factors, because calcium is actually important when you have your platelets clotting up that area plugging up that
aggregating,
area.
Aggregating, Michael.
Yes. So when you've got the platelets that have aggregated at the damaged site.
Loitering.
Calcium is present.
Yeah.
Now, platelets are negatively charged. Coagulation factors are also negatively charged now. So negative and negative can't bind together. So we need a happy intermediate to bring them together. That's calcium. So without vitamin K, we can't negatively charge our coagulation factors, which means they can't bind to calcium, which means calcium can't bind to platelets, which means there's no coagulation factors binding to platelets.
All right.
Okay. So vitamin K doesn't change the abundance of coagulation factors. It just changes whether they're negatively charged and have an ability to bind.
All right. And so when a baby's born, doesn't have any vitamin K, that's why they get the vitamin K shot.
That's right.
But eventually you'll get that through your bacteria in your gut.
Yeah. So a lot of people, you know, they think that they have an immature coagulation system. But they don't. They've got the ability to coagulate just fine.
Just no vitamin K.
It's just you need that vitamin K to carboxylate the coagulation factors, make them negative to bind to the calcium, to bind to the platelet.
And so warfarin interferes with this.
That's right.
Okay. Well, on calcium, because it, as you said, it plays a very important role in clotting. When you take whole blood, what they would have figured out pretty early on is it clots pretty quickly. So
to tell me about it.
So to do transfusions before they could even get to that point, they had to figure out putting certain things into the blood, one being citrate, and that stops the calcium reaction.
Exactly.
And it stays in fluid and doesn't.
So that calcium is stopping the coagulation factors binding to the platelets. Look at that. Look at this bringing physiology together. It's quite nice, isn't it?
Well done.
Thank you.
So that's buffy coat done.
Yeah, now we're at the last layer, the heaviest sediment layer, which is made up of 45% of the remaining blood, which is all one type of cell. Erythrocytes.
Right.
Red blood cells.
Red blood cells.
And there's so many of these.
So urethro means red?
Yeah, erythro does.
Okay.
And site means cell.
Good.
And how many of these are there per mil?
Many.
Okay, how many is many?
I think you have 25 billion in a teaspoon of blood.
Yeah, so you have about 5 million per mil.
That's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, it's one of the most abundant cells in the body.
You make 2 million a second. And you make 4 million leukocytes. Sorry, you make.
I was going to say, it sounds like Jeff Bezos.
You make.
He makes about 2 million a second.
You probably. You make double that of platelets per second.
You make more platelets than red blood cells, yeah. but you've got more red blood cells than platelets.
Yeah, but they die quickly.
Ah, okay, there you go. So higher turnover. Okay, gotcha.
But 2 million a second's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't think I could count that fast. And I'm immortal. So what the erythrocytes do is they basically are just gas-carrying molecules. So in actual fact, and I think this is probably where we should bring hematopoiesis in, because we can then, once we get to a stem cell all the way to a red blood cell, we can talk about why they are best suited to carry gases.
Right.
Does that sound okay?
Yep.
So I don't know how much detail you wanted to go in for erythropoiesis, but can I start and then you can fill in any gaps that you think are important?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Okay, so if you take red bone marrow, so where can you find red bone marrow? In bone.
At what age?
Oh, good point. Let's say adult. Okay, yeah, let's say child, and then we'll move to adult.
Not newborn.
Okay, let's say newborn. Okay.
Well,
you define the rules.
So this stem cell, which is in your bone marrow as an
just
adult.
Just tell me where red bone marrow is.
I'm just going to say how it moves, and then it's all yours. So early age of embryology, it's in the yolk sac. Then it moves to the liver and spleen.
The red bone marrow.
Well, the thing that's going to make bone, the blood cells.
Okay.
Then it goes into long bones.
What's it?
And then
where'd it start? Yolk sac.
Yolk sac.
Then spleen.
Spleen, liver.
Yeah.
And then it will go into...
What age are we talking about here?
Spleen, liver. This is still embryo.
Okay.
And then probably when you're born. Long bones can do it. But then when you kind of become more adult, predominantly in flat bones.
Yeah.
The only long
sternum
bone that
skull.
Really... Yeah, the only real long bone that does it is probably the proximal femur.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
So now you go.
All right. So the red bone marrow is carrying these hematopoietic stem cells. So poiesis means you can... Well, actually, I don't know what poiesis means, but I think poiesis means you can continually produce. Right? I think, or something along those lines. So basically, you start off with a hematopoietic stem cell in the red bone marrow. And this cell turns into something called a proerythroblast, which then turns into something called an early erythrocyte, which then turns into a late erythrocyte, and then turns into something called a reticulocyte. Now, interestingly, this reticulocyte has lost its nucleus. It's gone. And this reticulocyte will jump into the bloodstream from the red bone marrow. And after around about 2 to 3 days, it starts to change its shape and molds itself into that beautiful donut-looking shape of the red blood cell, which lasts around about 120
days. How big is it?
It's around about 7 to 10 micrometers in size. Tiny. Tiny for a cell. Now,
it's 80 in a salamander. That's a large. It's the largest red blood cell in vertebrates.
Do you know why?
well, only mammals lose the nucleus.
Okay.
So it's only the mammals that will lose all the organelles. All the other lower vertebrates will have all the organelles in the red blood cells. That suggests that mammals just need a great deal more oxygen.
It also would suggest potentially that
yeah.
those other animals can regenerate damaged
possibly.
Red blood cells.
Possibly.
So
I think when you do have a red blood cell, when you do have a nucleus in your red blood cells, by default it becomes more oval shaped.
Yes. Yeah.
Whereas when you lose it, it changes its shape. I think for at least humans, I'm not sure about all the mammals, but I think at least humans, it will become a more of a donut looking one because of its ability to really squeeze into small things.
Yes.
Small capillaries. I think also the shape of it gives it a better surface area to volume ratio.
For gas exchange. Absolutely. Yeah. Now, here's a quick test. Four things you need to produce a red blood cell from a hematopoietic stem cell.
Okay.
What do you need?
You mean like ingredients?
Yeah.
I guess iron.
Okay, iron's one.
Proteins?
Amino acids, yep.
Is this just the building blocks?
They're rate limiters.
Oh.
The next two are vitamins.
B12?
Yes.
Folate.
Yes, that's right. So they're the four things that you must have in order to produce healthy red blood cells.
Which is good because we can then talk about this quickly in terms of anemias.
So,
which anemia just means a problem with red blood cells generally.
Are you okay with the way that I spoke about that hematopoiesis?
Yeah, yeah.
That's a nice simple way.
Yeah.
Now, let's just hang on that red blood cell for a second. And the surface area is important. Like you said, its shape allows it to bend, change its ability to move its way through capillaries, because many capillaries, it's only one red blood cell wide, so 7 to 10 microns diameter, a number of capillaries. So it goes single line through a number of these, and it needs to have that capacity to bend and change its shape. If it doesn't, then it's targeted for degradation, goes off to the spleen to be recycled, which we'll talk about in a sec. And liver to be recycled.
And I wonder if that's got something to do also with where it once was as origination.
Maybe. Its surface area as well, like you were saying, because it's just packed with hemoglobin.
I think it's 97% of the volume of the red blood cell is hemoglobin.
Yeah, it's crazy. And so if you've packed with hemoglobin, there's no nucleus, there's no organelles, it's just hemoglobin basically, and each hemoglobin carries 4 oxygen, for example, you end up having a capacity, I think there's 250 million hemoglobin per red blood cell, each carrying 4 oxygen, so it's 1 billion oxygen per red blood cell, and we have 5 million per mil. We've got a huge capacity to carry oxygen. And because it's packed with oxygen, even the oxygen deep in the center of the red blood cell needs to diffuse out. And if it was perfectly round like a ball, you'd think that the oxygen right in the middle would have the most difficult time diffusing out because it's got the furthest distance to travel. But if it's squished like a donut, doesn't matter where the oxygen is, it's got the same distance to diffuse out of the cell. And that's awesome.
Yeah.
So it can get through the cell because it can change shape and it allows for diffusion to occur, which is beautiful. Now, what do you want to talk about with red blood cells? So you said you wanted to talk about something important. Anemias.
I can't remember now. Well, I was just going to say in terms of I think the shape is, you're correct in terms of it's a combination of it needs a huge amount of space to carry a lot of oxygen. It needs to be flexible. I read something that said if it did have mitochondria, then it would be just some of this oxygen that's carrying, it would start to make ATP with it. Oh. So, which would maybe be pointless because there's probably no real reason for why
red blood cell needs ATP.
Much ATP. I think the small amount of ATP that does make allows it to hold its shape to a degree.
Yeah.
Now, when it goes into, so as you said, it gets sent through the body, you know, all parts of the body, but spleen and liver play a particular role in trying to measure its flexibility.
Yeah, true. That's a good point.
And so it shoots the blood through this network. I think it's called red pulp, which is kind of a trabeculated network of blood vessels. And for the blood to go into the red pulp, I think it's okay, but to then get back into the circulation, it needs to go through a very difficult maze.
It's like the trials for an Olympic competition. When you start off with 50 athletes.
Or that Ninja Warrior.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's true. That's better.
And so if you're old and decrepit, you can't...
Like me, is that what you're saying?
No. You can't get across that first swing.
Yeah, or whatever. That's true.
And so you can't fit through, and then sitting right there on the side is a specialized type of macrophage, which just says, look, mate, you're too old.
And they eat you, Soylent Green.
And they'll just chomp you up.
Look at that.
And that then makes, you know, you get recycled.
Yes.
Certain parts get sent back to certain areas. So you don't lose it, particularly iron, because iron's very important.
Well, okay. So let's talk about that recycling very quickly. Because when you destroy a red blood cell, it's pretty much just hemoglobin. And hemoglobin is heme, globin, and the iron that's in the heme. So it's easy. You take the globin, which are just amino acids, and you throw it back and it can be recycled for more hematopoiesis.
Or any other functions. Any kind of protein.
You take the iron, you can chuck it back to hematopoiesis. You can make more...
Send back to the bone marrow.
Correct. You take the heme, well, it's a bit more difficult to recycle. And so that heme gets sent to the liver and it goes through quite an extensive process where it turns into biliverdin, bilirubin and so forth, goes to the bile. That bile then gets excreted into the... intestines, where it gets changed again.
And that gives the poo colour.
Yes, or it can go through into the urine.
And that gives it a yellow colour.
And gives it its yellow colour.
And that's probably why the plasma is yellow.
Correct.
So that's...
Because of recycled heme.
Yeah, I think... That's the main part. Now, when you go to anemias.
Which you think I have.
Yeah.
You so arrogant mortal.
So there's a few different, well, there's many types. So anemia just basically means a problem with the amount of hemoglobin. So, which usually correlates to a problem with the red blood cell. But I think the most accurate way of knowing anemia, it's just a reduction in hemoglobin. Okay, I think anything kind of under 10 grams per 100 mils is considered potentially anemic.
Okay.
Now, but usually that's correlated strongly to a low amount of red blood cells. Now, with your explanation of how you go from a stem cell in your bone marrow to a normal functioning red blood cell, that probably takes about 20 days to go from the marrow to the blood. Okay. And like you said, it goes through an immature stage, which still has its nucleus in it. So if you have a dysfunction or a deficiency, should I say, of some of those vitamins, what were the two main vitamins?
B12 and folate.
Yeah. So particularly these two, if you have a deficiency in those two, what will happen is the cell going from an immature state into a mature state has the problem. So it stays bigger. And this is what we call megaloblastic or megacytic anemias, which is just basically they're an immature type of red blood cell, so they're not as efficient. They haven't got as much hemoglobin in them. But if you look under a blood smear, the red blood cells would be bigger. Because you're deficient in those two vitamins, you have a problem with the way that you convert the DNA or compact the DNA.
Okay.
So the cell stays big.
Ah.
And so any kind of anemia, so low hemoglobin with big red blood cells, would suggest it's megacytic, large cell, which suggests it's probably, you know, statistically going to be a B12 or a folate issue.
Interesting.
An example would be pernicious anemia.
Yeah.
And that would be a problem with intrinsic factor in the stomach. Sometimes people have problems with their stomach or the conversion of B12, and then
yeah, sometimes gastritis over time,
or the absorption in the ileum. So Crohn's disease could have a problem here because that's where you absorb the B12. Now the other one is the small anemias. So still anemia, but the red blood cells are very small. But
it's not mega this time.
It's microcytic, okay. And this classic one would be iron deficiency anemia, which is I think your one. So you lack enough iron, and as we said, you need iron, 4 bits of iron to complete a hemoglobin. So if you're deficient in iron, you can't make as many hemoglobins. So when you complete your red blood cell, there's less hemoglobins to chuck into it. So by default, the cell will just be a smaller cell. So they're microcytic.
Okay. Look, I don't think that's exactly what's wrong with me. I don't think there's a problem at all. I just think being immortal is probably a win-win. Sure, I've got to eat blood all the time, but I think I get enough iron from the blood that I eat.
Maybe you just don't absorb it. Maybe you've got an absorption problem.
I do have gastritis. It's common
reflux.
Yes. I think it's quite common for vampires.
To get reflux. Okay.
It's gross.
Now, the last one is normocytic anemia. So you've got normal red blood cells, right, but you're sterile anemic. So some good examples of this would be if you've got just bleeding, so you've just lost without knowing, you're just losing blood. Mm. Now, then finally...
How did that happen? How do you just bleed without knowing you're losing blood?
Oh, well, you could have a bleed in your gastrointestinal tract, or you've got internal bleeding. You just don't know that you are losing blood.
Yes, true.
So with this form of anemia, because the red blood cells is normal, you might struggle to think, well, what's wrong with me? I don't know why I've got a low amount of hemoglobin when I've got normal red blood cells. Well, the good way to differentiate this is to take, again, a blood smear. And if it is a problem with loss of blood, what is the body's... How do you think the body would try to react to
increase blood pressure.
No, to counter
loss of blood.
A low amount of red blood cells.
The kidneys will stimulate the release of erythropoietin, EPO,
yep,
to produce more red blood cells.
Right, that's right. And so you'd be producing more red blood cells. And so if you took a person's blood, how would you know if they are bumping up their red blood cell production?
Check EPO.
Well, you could do that, or you could just look at the reticulocyte number. And if the reticular, they're the immature ones. If you've got a high reticulocyte number, you are suggesting that they are trying to produce the red blood cells to counter the problem.
Okay.
So it's a destruction issue, not a production issue. If you had a production issue, this would be suggesting that you've got a problem with your bone marrow. And so this is where you'd have leukemias, which means that you're losing, through cancer in the bone marrow, you're losing the ability to make red blood cells.
Interesting.
And so as a common side effect of and of the leukemias would be forms of anemia.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, that's pretty good. It's pretty good.
And I'll just make one final point. For some interesting reason, with the leukemias, because they are a cancer-like cell at the stem cell level, they go back to their original form, which is what they were like in the embryo. And so when they're out in the blood, because that's what leukemia is, it's a cancer of blood cells in your blood, they go to a place that they feel safe, and that's go back to the safe time of the embryo.
Liver,
and
spleen.
And so they sometimes will hang out in the liver and spleen, so that you'll start to get the accumulation of the tumors in those two locations. So that's because it goes back to the embryology days, where that's where they were first made.
Okay, wow. Wow, 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 wow. All right, well, you know, I know I'm a hematologist. I probably should know these things, but I find that pretty
interesting. You're an old hematologist, so you probably forgot a lot.
Yeah, my memory is pretty poor.
Really quickly, because you should do this, because you're the expert in blood.
Transfusions? Yeah. Well, I'm just an expert in receiving blood, really, but I can talk about blood transfusions. I can do it very quickly.
So just do the blood type in.
Okay, so very quickly, what you're going to find is that on all your red blood cells, you're going to have a little flag on it called an antigen. And an antigen is a protein, which basically says, I belong to you. Now, with red blood cells, there's many different type of blood antigens, which we call the blood types. The most common, that and those that are most clinically important for transfusions, are going to be the ABO antigens. So you've got A antigen. So,
A flag.
So you can have a red blood cell with an A flag. You can have a red blood cell with a B flag. Or you can have a red blood cell with no flag, and that's an O.
Or both an A and a B.
Or you can have a red blood cell that has an A flag and a B flag, and that's AB. Now, I want you to think about it like this. If you're carrying a flag to say, I am this, and you can think about Game of Thrones, for example. If they're waving a flag that says, I am this house, their army isn't trained to attack that flag. Their army is trained to attack every other flag that is not that flag, mm-hmm. right? So if you have a red blood cell that has an A flag on it, your army, which is your antibodies, will not attack that flag. It'll attack every other.
So they got weapons for the B flag.
Correct. And these are your immune cells, your T and your B cells, right? So if you have an A flag on your red blood cell, your army is trained to attack every other flag, and there's only one other flag, that's the B flag. So you can't receive B blood. Because your army will attack it and destroy it. You'll get sick. So if you have the B flag, your army is trained to attack the A blood. So you can't receive A blood if you are B. If you have both the A flag and the B flag,
AB.
Your army isn't trained to attack anyone. There's no other flags to identify and attack. So you can receive every blood type when
that's
you are AB.
You got.
Thank you. And if you are O, you have no flag. You're like a Bedouin tribe, right? But your army is trained to attack everybody. Your army wants to attack both A flags and B flags. And when you're O blood type, you can't receive any blood but your
except
own.
Your own.
Now, this is where another flag comes in on top called the rhesus factor.
So this is the positive part.
Yes, rhesus, like the rhesus monkey, because this is where they first identify it. And the rhesus factor is simple.
Have you this had blood from a rhesus monkey?
Yes, I have.
Are they all positive?
Look, I like the... But I like the rhesus negative blood. It's just a connoisseur sort of thing. You wouldn't understand. So rhesus, if you have this flag, which is D, right? The rhesus factor is D. If you have that flag, you're positive. So if you have a red blood cell and you have an A flag on it and a D flag, you're A positive. If you have a red blood cell that has an A flag and that's it, you're A negative. If you have a red blood cell with no flag but only the rhesus factor D flag, you're O positive. If you have no flags on any red blood cells, O negative. Does that make sense?
Right.
And the only way you think about it, if you're sitting there going, how do I know who can receive blood from who? You can only receive blood from people who have the same flag. So what I mean is this. If you are A, B, B, positive. You have the A flag, the B flag, and the racist factor flag. Your army isn't trained to attack anyone.
Yep.
So you can receive A positive, A negative, B positive, B negative, O positive, O negative, AB positive, AB negative blood. If you are O negative, your army's trained to attack everyone. A, B, and racist factor. Now, so if you have the racist factor flag, you can receive blood without racist factor. But the thing is this, your army doesn't know about racist factor until they first come across it. So what that means is while you may be born with an army or antibodies that can attack A or B, depending on your flag, your army doesn't know that racist factor exists until it first comes across it. And this is what's important when it comes to pregnancies and births.
Yeah.
Is the rhesus factor. So if you are a mother and you're rhesus negative and you have a child who is rhesus positive.
The first one, let's say.
The first one.
Yep.
It's usually fine. But
you build antibodies against it.
You build antibodies against it because often.
During birth and stuff.
During birth, yes. When the blood finally sort of mixes together.
And then the second birth, if they are a positive.
Again.
Then the maternal antibodies will potentially cause a problem to the developing fetus.
That's right. And so you need to have some immunosuppressive drugs to suppress the rhesus factor from the mother. And that's it.
Great.
That was quick.
Well done, Dr. Kula.
Dr. Acula.
Acula, sorry.
Jeez, it's only been an hour and...
19 minutes.
19 minutes.
So thanks for coming today. We really appreciated your input.
Oh, that's okay. I know
your knowledge,
you needed it.
Your experience.
Michael's a bit of a moron.
Rage.
Yes. Attractiveness. Tautness.
Yeah. Any final points you'd like to make? I think we've covered pretty much everything blood related.
Oh yeah, just one final point. Don't wear scarves. No need to cover that neck. Keep it bare, keep it open, show it off.
Do you prefer positive or negative blood?
I just told you, I don't like the rhesus positive. Rhesus negative is the way to go, always.
Sorry. Okay.
But it's just like saying, what vintage of wine do you prefer, right? So,
just one final point.
Yes.
In terms of the age, is there any truth to the idea or the notion that that you can, if you were to take blood from a younger person or organism, that you may it may have some benefit in terms of virulence?
Why do you think I drink blood? Why do you think I only drink blood?
I was actually meaning if you had some peer-reviewed kind of evidence, not just your own.
Well, from my experience, anecdotally, I already knew that young blood is what keeps me young. This is why I look so good right now.
Correct, yep.
And then the evidence followed. And the evidence shows that if you take the blood from a young mouse and put it into an old mouse, it limits neurodegeneration. It benefits them in regards to memory and brain function.
How do they do this?
They take the blood and they put it in.
No, they actually sew them together.
Yes. Yes, they do actually.
So they actually get the two mice.
It's not my preferred method.
They kind of make an incision so that they're kind of overlapping. They put the blood vessels, anastomose the blood vessels, and then just sew them up so they're like kind of conjoined twins.
Yes.
And then they go.
Measure the markers and they show.
So that's not the method. That's not the method that you go by?
No. I just go straight to the source.
Okay.
So, for me, delicious. And keeps me young.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I still think you got some anemia issues.
Okay. So, you don't think people should just go and get other people's blood and
definitely
ingest it?
It would be unethical.
Okay. Yeah.
But thank you for coming in. I've appreciated it.
That's okay. That's okay.
Hopefully, I'm not sure who's worse, really, you or Mike, but... If it looks
like a duck and sounds like a duck,
yeah,
it's probably a vampire.
Okay. All right, doctor. Any final words before this could be your last time on air?
Stop eating garlic. Don't bother carrying around any steaks unless they're ribeyes. And keep your neck bare and available.
Okay. All right, listeners. Because Mike's going to be back next week, with our next topic.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.